G'day you mob, how's it going? Pete here from Aussie English, and this is obviously another Aussie English episode. So today I have an interview episode for you where I sit down with Kyron Down. Kyron Down is from Brisbane, Australia. He is a fair dinkum true blue Aussie guy. He studied mining engineering at university. He then later went on to become, obviously, a mining engineer working for Rio Tinto. He then threw it all away to globetrot to travel around the world, including South America and Central America, as well as Asia, start learning languages. He fell in love with a Colombian. He's just had a really interesting story, and the guy's not even 30 years old yet, right? So, yeah. Anyway, he reached out after the Beck and Penelope episode that I did recently, the interview episode with the girls from the Language Chats podcast, and just said that he loved what I was doing with the podcast. We sort of had a bit of a chat, got to know one another. He's got a podcast called Mere Mortals, so go check that out, guys. And yeah, we just had a lot in common. He is a minimalist at heart now. He likes to talk about deeper topics. So, this interview ended up going for about 2 hours, which is why I've split it up into two parts. Today's the first part, and I will release the second part soon. Anyway, without any further ado, guys, let's get into it. G'day, you mob. Welcome to this episode of Aussie English. Today, I have special guest Kyron Down, who is the host of the Mere Mortals podcast. But more than that, you have a pretty interesting background, as I was just telling you that I was looking into your LinkedIn. So, yeah, you've worked in mining. You've done quite a bit of extensive traveling, as you can probably see, guys, if you're watching the video. There's a picture of South America behind him.
Got my Argentina beanie on as well, so.
How dare you, dude. You got Brazil behind you on the map, and then you got the Argentinian.
funnily enough, this one gets insulted a lot because it almost looks like chucks.
Ah.
So, I've had a couple of times people being like, are you wearing chucks on your head? And I just went, there's a lot of Argentinians who would not be happy about that.
For those of you who don't know, chucks, I assume you mean the stuff you clean the kitchen with,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
These are blue and white wipes.
Yep.
But yeah, you've also had some background in mining engineering and working for Rio Tinto, which is really interesting because I don't know if the listeners will remember, but I had one of my friends on a few years ago who was named Matt, and he had finished mining at Melbourne University, and I think he worked for Rio Tinto, and then after 3 years decided to just ditch that and go around South America for a year and a half.
Was his name Matt Widenbury?
No.
Okay. I was going to say that I might, because that does sound like the story of a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I guess we could start with, you are different from me in that you grew up in Brisbane. So, what was life like growing up in Brisbane in Queensland, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, Brisbane's my hometown, so I'm always going to say, you know, good things about it. So,
Give us the honest truth, though. You give us the underbelly, the dark side.
Yeah, the dark. Well, I can give you a bit of the dark underbelly. So, I grew up between Brisbane and the Gold Coast. So, those two are about an hour apart, and I was halfway between those. And that was the Logan area. So, I guess you could say I'm a Logan Bogan if you really want to get to it. I always used to say I was in the nice part of Logan. But
that wouldn't have been the first go-to for me, the Logan Bogan. But so that's the sort of slang term that gets thrown around, is it, for Loganites?
I mean, for sure. And it's look, honestly, Logan really isn't that bad. Like, if you compared to everywhere else, it's sort of, it's the same. It's got, you know, its troubles and whatnot, but for the most part, it's good.
It sounds like Geelong, which is where I'm from. Yeah. It's it's okay, but it's pretty rough at times too. it's a bit rough around the edges, but you know, what can you do? Yeah. So Brisbane, I guess you guys have all the good things. You're not too far north, not too far south. You're just right.
That's pretty much what I say. I mean, like, the weather's, you know, nice as well. I mean, I'm a little bit of a complainer, so I'm decked out in my jumpers and stuff, even though it's, you know, barely winter here.
Are you allowed to own those as a Queenslander? Or
I think it's a little bit on the sketchy side. I try and get away with it.
I remember when I was doing biology at Melbourne Uni, and I was going up to Bundaberg to do the turtle volunteering up there.
every time you would go to Bundaberg, I would never be able to wear more than a singlet and shorts, even at night, because it would be, in summer at least, it would be 35 at night, 35 yeah. during the day. Yeah. So this is probably halfway between Cairns and Brisbane, for those wondering. But I remember always going to the mall and you would see people in full tracksuits and you'd just be like, you guys are psychos. Like, what are you doing? Yeah, but I guess you get acclimated to it.
People are different, man. People are... I'm the same. I sort of try and stay in the middle zone. I remember when I was a kid, though, I would brave the winters in essence, and people would think I'm crazy. But it was like, this isn't too bad because my mom's actually from New Zealand, so I feel like I've got a bit of Kiwi blood in me to protect me. But now I've been in Australia so long, it's like, nah, any slightest bit of cold, and I'm out.
It's funny how used to it you get, though. Like my wife. I met my wife. She's Brazilian from Maranhão in the north. So I guess I think behind your head there, it'd be
that would be
right up the middle there. Yeah, like about half a foot in front above your hand there. So São Luís is the town that she's from. So which is right near the Amazon and where it opens up. I think sort of a little bit further north. But yeah, so she's from like 2 degrees south. I think maybe south of the equator and came to Australia. And was whinging about the heat in Townsville. And I'm like, that's even further south. And then the whole time was just like, we need to live somewhere like Melbourne. If we can get to Tasmania, let's do that. Cause just fuck this heat, man. And I'm like, you grew up somewhere where it was like literally 35 every hour of the day. And she's like, yeah, exactly. Screw that. But it's funny how she was obviously used to it for her entire life. You know, I notice when I go to Queensland, I start sweating a lot. But then after a week or two, your body kind of gets used to it and it's just like, oh, okay, I don't have to sweat like I used to. You know, it's really funny how it kind of acclimates after a little bit. And I think it's probably the same for the cold. You'd come to Melbourne and then have your first winter and be, you know, sleeping in a full tracksuit and bitching about it. And then after that, you'd be like, oh, this is great. I can't go north.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so was it all glamorous though? Is Brisbane gets kind of a bit of shit, I think, from the rest of us, right? We always, you know, the Melbourneers and the Sydney-siders just crap on pretty much every other city in Australia. But I often think when I went to Brisbane, I kept saying to Kel, my wife, we should live there. It's kind of like a better version of both Sydney and Melbourne because it's smaller and it's warmer and nicer in comparison to Melbourne.
Yeah, I think like for me, it's just got all the amenities. So, you know, all the good stuff that you can get in Melbourne and whatnot. You know, we pretty much have it here. Like I'm really struggling to think of things that, you know, people say, oh, the nightlife and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, it just depends how many options you want. There's for me, I'm definitely like, you know, if there's 50 different tubs of toothpaste in the grocery store or something, it's like, do I really need all of these? I'm pretty sure like if I just had 4 to choose from, I'd still be good as well.
Well, isn't that, what is it called? Like choice fatigue? That you end up getting. Yeah, I remember there used to be a few Asian restaurants that we would love going to in Melbourne when I was living in the city there studying. And I remember sometimes I would just get massive choice fatigue because I'd open up the menu and there'd be 250 options. And
yeah, that's ridiculous.
I would just be like, I feel like whatever I choose, it's not going to be what I really want.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone else is going to get something and I'll be like, damn, I wish I got that. Whereas if it was 12 items, I would have been like, whatever I end up getting, it's going to be I'm going to feel so much more satisfied.
Definitely.
Yeah, crazy.
But yeah, so- nothing in particular. Like, I love Brisbane as a city, as a place. It's always been pretty good for me, and yeah, never had any problems with it, I guess.
Are there lots of migrants now in Brisbane as the city? Because that was something that I noticed in Melbourne when I first started studying there. It would have been 2006. There were quite a few migrants, but it seemed to over the next, well, I guess it would be 15 years. It seemed to go through waves of like different groups. So I remember at first there were a lot of Chinese, Indonesian, Japanese, a lot of Southeast Asianers and Asianers that would come over and were studying there. But then it was interesting because it kind of changed. You had suddenly this influx of Colombians. And then maybe 5 years ago, maybe a bit longer than 5 years, 10 years ago, Brazilians like crazy. And so it was really interesting to see the sort of demographic change that took place inside the actual city itself.
Yeah.
Has that been something you've noticed in your lifetime in Brisbane?
I've definitely noticed some things, but it's hard to tell if it's just, you know, my tiny perspective and the people I tend to draw in and whatnot, or if it's as a whole trend. But yeah, definitely for me, it was probably like around the high school years was when I started to notice like, oh, wow, there's a lot of like islanders here, for example. So Fijians, Samoans, you know, Kiwis. Everyone just seemed to be coming in, and that's who the people I was, you know, making friends with and just interacting with. Could have been just my high school, but also, you know, that was the feeling in the air, I guess. Nowadays, I would say, yeah, it's definitely like the Asian culture's coming in pretty hard, but not as maybe as hard as for me. Actually traveling to Melbourne, going along the Great Asian Road, that was surprising seeing how everywhere had English and then Chinese.
Oh yeah,
you know, everywhere. I just was not expecting that. So
did you get blown away by the signs that said make sure you drive on the left, or in Australia
drive
on the left? I remember we would always go down the Great Ocean Road and I'd be like, Dad, why the hell are these signs here? Because they're never anywhere else. You don't ever see them anywhere else. And he's like, clearly there's been enough accidents with people who forgot that you drive on the left here because they're tourists. And the Chinese are interesting because I think a lot of the time they come to the big cities, but they kind of do their own tourist thing where they go in really large groups using buses. So they must all sort of go to the, you know, Wilson's Promontory and Gippsland. And then on the other side, it'll be the Grampians and the Great Ocean Road. So
yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? You see that. I remember there was a sign in one of the chocolate stores that was like, don't stand on the toilet. In an Asian language. And I was just like, that's just something that would never occur to me. But then I remember when I was traveling around Indonesia, a lot of the places didn't have toilets and you would have to squat over a hole. And so I'm like,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, I guess that makes sense, you know, to some degree.
And this is where you start to get all those funny memes of like, you know, all the crazy toilet things of what you are and aren't allowed to do.
Those
are always great.
These are those interesting moments you have. I think you probably have gone through many more of these than me because you've done more traveling, it seems, especially in South America and throughout Asia. You become so much more aware of how it's kind of all arbitrary, you know, these cultural standards and what we think is okay. You know, like here you can't really spit on the street, right? Or at least it's a sort of no-no. Yeah. But in many other countries, that's kind of just, it's just not a big deal. No one cares. You just do whatever you want to do. And I remember one thing that I went through when I was in Indonesia was there was a lot of litter everywhere. Like people just threw, they'd finish, you know, I don't know. There was one scene, we were crossing a river in the jungle. We were doing some field work for my PhD supervisor. And one of the guys took the batteries out of his camera and just threw them in the river. And I was like, dude, what the fuck? What are you doing? You can't, we're in the pristine jungle. You can't just throw batteries in the river. And he was just like gone. Gone, disappear. And I'm like, dude, your village is downstream from the river. Like the batteries are going down there. Well, they're going to leak out all of this unwanted crap. And I remember my supervisor being like, he's got other priorities, dude. He doesn't have time to worry about this kind of shit. This is a very Westerner kind of way of thinking about it. And it was like one of those moments where you were like, oh my God, I'm so, you know, just locked in my own cultural perspective of the world. And it's good to kind of get an outside perspective of like, you know, these people were some of the happiest people I'd ever met, but some of the people that had the least that I'd ever met as well. You know, they didn't have internet or phone in some of these villages, and yet they were the happiest people running around making jokes and wanting to play with you and touch your skin and be like, oh, white guy, you know. It was really interesting. But did you get to experience that whilst you were doing a lot of travel after you finished?
You definitely get bits and pieces. I remember the one that sticks out for me was my ex was Colombian, and I'd sort of like met her in Argentina a couple of months later, like met her and her parents in Colombia, and then met her back in Argentina again. And there was just this one point where we're just discussing the relationship or something. And she was like, oh yeah, but we're not really boyfriend and girlfriend yet. And I was going, oh, okay. I thought we'd like definitely reach that point. And she was saying, no, it's not until you say te amo that it's, you know, we're official,
okay.
Which is, you know, the translation,
I love you.
And I just went, whoa, that's way more than, you know, in Australia, like I'd not feel comfortable saying like, I love you as the next instigator for being boyfriend and girlfriend. That's like, all down the line. So
it's even that I haven't really thought about. There's a thing in Brazil where they call it ficar, which means to stay with. Right. I think, and Brazilians are going to ream me because I don't really still get the whole dating culture because I dated one Brazilian.
Yeah.
And I ended up marrying her. So this is my my N of one. But they have this thing called ficar where I think it's kind of like hooking up, but a little more than hooking up. It's not like a one night stand, but it's not an official your boyfriend and girlfriend thing here. And you can be ficar ring with various people at the same time. So it is very, it's interesting how you have these different cultural expectations around relationships and what is and isn't okay, you know, and the same with me. I think when I was in Melbourne as a single student dating people, I mean, I guess it happens within cultures too, but it would be, I was dating one person at a time. Whereas, you know, in other places around the world, at least in Brazil, I've heard it's much more acceptable to be, you know, being able to date multiple people. It's not a big deal, but then once it becomes serious, it does. And so it's interesting how those things differ.
Yeah. I had a Brazilian friend here who was telling me how, you know, everyone in Brazil would go out to the clubs and whatnot to basically, like, you know, meet other people, meet partners and whatnot. And I was saying, oh, what if you're like introverted like me and you don't really get out that much? He's like, no, everyone goes out to the club. Like, no, you don't get a choice.
I don't think there are any Brazilian introverts, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, that's probably why.
Well, that was one thing I heard from a girl that was my ex's sister. She had been dating a Brazilian guy and she was like, these guys are hypersexual in comparison to she was Australian. In comparison to Australian guys. And I think that was one of these things where she at least was really attracted to it, because she was like, Australian guys are always waiting and they're sort of, you know, much more unsure of themselves. Whereas this guy just went in for the kill the moment he saw me. And I was just like, yeah, I would totally not be doing that with someone I didn't know. And then the other side of it is like my wife, Kel, is like, oh man, I can't handle Brazilian guys. You know, like they're too full on. And I mean, obviously this is a stereotype. Not every Brazilian is like that, but it was really interesting hearing from both these two women from opposite sides of the ocean.
Yeah.
That they were enamored and unenamored, I guess, with the same things. And it's probably the whole, you don't like what you have. You kind of find the external thing kind of interesting and different and exotic. You know, I'm constantly like, Kel, let's go to Brazil. It's going to be amazing. The place looks phenomenal. And she's like, yeah, no, like I grew up there. I don't want to go back. And I'm like, well, I don't want to stay in Australia because I grew up here and I don't want to stay here. You know, I want to go around and see the place. And so it's interesting how much you're sort of like, the grass is greener, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And it depends on like, yeah, I think on the person as well. You know, there's always that sort of saying, there's more difference, you know, in groups than between groups. So even though you take like your average Colombian or average Australian, and there's not that much difference compared to, well, the difference between them isn't as big as just say the people within Colombia and the people within Australia. So
probably matters where you meet them too, because I imagine for me at least, the average Colombian I've met probably doesn't represent Colombians very well, because they're all the ones that have come to Australia that are probably, you know, relatively well off, a certain demographic, have a certain goal. The same with like Europeans that meet Australians on Contiki. It's like, don't think that's the average. Please, dear God, don't think that that is what represents the average Australian.
Yeah.
So how did you end up getting into mining? Is that something that you always wanted to do as a kid, or you just fell into it?
So I was always really good at science, maths, physics, those sorts of things. Just math. But I had no idea what I wanted to do growing up, whatever. So my dad, in my final year, sort of took me to just a couple of different workplaces of, you know, his friends, and I would get to spend a day in a, you know, electrical engineering, a day with just other random stuff. And one of his friends is a mining engineer, and they let me sit with the graduate. And honestly, it was so simple how big changes in your life can come from these small things. And he was just showing me on his computer, just like a 3D image of a mine and like a CAD program. So, you know, he's moving it around and doing all these things. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then he showed me a PowerPoint of, you know, the biggest mining accidents that have happened. So landslides of dozers getting, you know, picked up by these gigantic machines that are hundreds of meters tall and things like that.
Jesus.
And I was just going, hell yeah, like that's awesome. That picked in my brain. So yeah, that's essentially why I got into it, went to uni, and then was like, oh, all right, I guess I'll do engineering and I'll do mining engineering. That sounds good enough.
Did you get to ever drive one of those big ass mining dump trucks that's like size of several houses?
Yep, for sure. Yeah, I've got a couple of photos of me standing next to it, and the wheels are double my height. And
Kel didn't believe me. I was showing Noah. Noah's obsessed with my son's obsessed with watching YouTube compilation videos of just trucks, you know? So there'll be like ambulances, and it's just like with the sirens on constantly, and he'll just sit there and watch it. And he's just like, fire truck, police car, ambulance. fire yeah. truck. And I'm like, you got it, son. You're crushing it. But then I put on the mining one because I was like, there must be some really cool mining videos. So lo and behold, there's a lot of channels that just do footage of mining. That might be, you know, your next sort of entrepreneurial thing. You just have to get into the mines and start filming it for kids. But yeah. My wife was looking at one of the trucks and she's like, looks pretty big. And I was like, wait, because it was coming towards the camera. And I'm like, see the guy in there? And she's like, oh, holy crap. I'm like, the tires are probably, you know, two times your height. You could hide. You could probably sit inside the tire rim, right? And you know, probably run whilst it moves.
Yeah, yeah, like a little giant hamster.
Yeah, it just looks ridiculous, right? But I imagine the size of these things is all just about efficiency of moving enough product or enough, what would you call it, pay dirt ore?
Yeah, yeah. Generally, the bigger the machine, obviously, the more it costs, but the more efficient it gets over time, just scale of economy sort of stuff. But yeah, when you get, the thing is like those aren't even that big when you get to, you know, the shovels or you get to a drag line, which like I was saying, it's, you know, imagine a crane that you just see and then imagine,
is this the one with that turning wheel that has like a whole bunch of buckets on it and it just literally goes along the edge of where the ore is and picks it up and shoves it onto the conveyor belt or?
No, that's a, it's, yeah. It's been 5 years since I've been in
that. Right. Oh, I'm not testing you. No marks. That,
yeah, no. A dragline is essentially like, imagine just a gigantic sort of like, if I had to guess, probably 50 meter by 50 meter by 50 meter box. So
yeah. You know,
half a soccer pitch just high up. And that's just the workings of it. And then there's a huge crane attached to it. And
yeah, I'm having a look at one of them now. The images. Holy moly. This is like the biggest digger you can imagine on steroids.
Yeah, yeah. And so those things, they just power through.
Holy moly.
And they'll just pick up dirt and chuck it, you know, way behind them and form like, you're essentially forming mountains behind them. You can, you know, if you had a snowboard or something and it was a nice chilly Brisbane day, although that not won't really happen. But yeah, you could, those things are huge, just gigantic.
How do they get these things to the mining place or do they have to construct them there? Because surely they don't fit in the roads.
Yeah, parts of it do. So they'll bring like, obviously there's like the real big stuff. You know, there's some things like you can't make a cog any smaller if it's yay big. So there are some things that they'll have to bring just through the roads and they'll just block off the whole road for however long and,
wow.
And just it'll just come along. But yeah, most of it's done through building it on site.
Good God, that'd be like ants making Lego, right? If you had a video of it over a time capture or something, like a time lapse.
Go on YouTube and you will definitely find a dragline build.
My son will get into that. Yeah, far out. So what made you decide to sort of get out of mining after 3 years? Because it tends to be one of those jobs that's renowned for being massively lucrative and, you know, you get to see a lot of the country quite often.
Yeah, look, honestly, the turnover rate while I was there was pretty high. I think I almost did well for getting to 3 years because it's
I was going to ask. Yeah. That was going to be the next question.
Yeah. It does pay well for sure, but there's a price you pay for that, and that's the isolation. That's the shitty work hours. That's the FIFO work. If you've ever done night shift, it's, you know, that stuff's terrible for your body. Like it's not good for you.
Also the shifts are like 10 on, 2 off or 5 off or whatever it is?
Yeah, it depends. Like you'll get some which are nice, which are more even. So it'll be like a 7-7, 6-6 or, you know, there's real weird ones as well that are like 4-3, 3-3, 4-4. You know, it just changes all the time. So
is that just arbitrary? Like it's based on how many workers you've got of a certain job and you'll just be like, all right, well, you're just going to say this week it's 3 days on, 4 days off for everyone and we'll just rotate through you.
Depends on the workers' unions as well. They sometimes they have a lot of say in like dictating what type of roster they want as well. So it's a bit of everything. You'll get some people who like these really short, sharp, changing ones because they can go home more often. And then there's probably more like, I don't know, younger single people who are like, I can do 3 weeks on, like that's okay, and I'll come back with, you know, 20 grand or whatever it is. So.
Well, I've had friends do that. I remember I was working at a pizza shop when I was in the end of high school. And I remember there was a guy there who was a miner and he was just like, yeah, I just went there for 3 years until I had enough to buy a house. And I was just like, fuck, that's insane. Like, but he's like, man, there's nothing to spend it on. You can spend it on booze and maybe prostitutes and food, but you've got nothing. If you're in the middle of Western Australia, You know, he's like, there's just literally nothing for you to waste the money on unless you're buying stuff there and being an idiot, you know, like a house or cars and stuff. But if you're being sensible and just working, it's not like you can go skiing or that you can hang out with your mates, you know, that you have to fly all the way home to really, you know, go nightclubbing and that sort of stuff properly.
Yeah, that's the problem though, because a lot of people will go home and then they will go
hard. Okay.
You know, I had a friend who, was in the mining boom, was just, you know, he was there for the good times and was like, he'd get off shift and be, I've got a week and a half to kill. What am I going to do? I'll just fly to New Zealand. I'll fly to Papua New Guinea. Like I'll fly to wherever, spend 3 or 4 days there and then come back. And that's just, you know, not the most efficient way to travel, for sure.
Or save money.
And honestly, the amount of people who have jet skis is ridiculous. And that was always my pet one. Like, if you have a jet ski and you're living in, you know, central Queensland, you're not getting much use out of it. So that was always like, what are you doing?
Wait, it must be hard, I guess. You know, you have these guys who are out of university and they would be on bugger all money if they were even working while studying. And then all of a sudden they're on, what, $120,000 to $200,000 a year, depending on what the job is. And, you know, a lot of the time they're working large chunks of time where they can't spend the money. So then they find themselves with these huge bank accounts. They go home and they're like, well, it came pretty easily. So I assume it's always going to be there coming in. It's sort of like the musicians that get rich really quickly, right? And then all the sports stars who get paid these ridiculous amounts of money and then burn through it because they haven't been taught. You need to invest. You need to be careful. Don't just buy Ferraris and houses that you're not going to use and you're going to want to get out of.
Yeah, for sure. And it, you know, it just depends where they come from. I found that the people who lived out there, like the sort of more country folk, I guess people who weren't doing the FIFO work, they generally were better with it because, you know, they'd grown up on the farms nearby and they had all the connections and stuff. So even if they did spend money, like it wasn't extreme. Whereas, and most of them aren't, you know, university graduates coming in. They're you know, sparkies, the diesel fitters, the you'll get like all these types of people. And then some of them are really, really young, 18 years old. And, you know, imagine getting more than your parents have ever earned just straight out of like high school, essentially. And it's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy when you think about it.
So it was mainly just the work hours and shifts and everything. And you were just like most people, you're just like, yeah, I'm burnt out. I need to do something different.
Yeah. So, I mean, like for me, it's kind of hard to say because I had probably one of the best gigs that you can ever get out there. I was working a 9-day fortnight. So when you're an engineer working in the office, you don't work those typical ones. You've got more closer to the 9-to-5 thing, although you still work longer hours. So I'd work 11 and a half, 12 hour days. But it'd be like Monday to Friday, Monday to Thursday. So I always had my weekends off, for example. I was in Mackay, which is a pretty big city, and it was only a drive in of an hour and a half to where I worked at. So all of that combined, like it was still kind of shit. Like you wouldn't have time to do, you know, go back. You could go back midweek, but you're so exhausted. You're not going to do anything on like a Tuesday or Wednesday night. Other than like I had a soccer team, so I would go to a training and then like eat, go to sleep and then go back out to the mine sort of thing. And I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it either. And I always just thought, you know, you can get, what is it? The average person works 80,000 hours. So in a lifetime. And so, you know, using that 10,000 hours to master anything rule, it's like, okay, what 8 things would I become a master at?
Mm-hmm.
You know, keeping my mouth shut in meetings and, you know, listening to what the boss says. Creating designs that are just going to be used up and then spit out the next week. And then I have to redo it all again. You know, talking with people who I didn't really care about, who are like, I wasn't good friends with about shit that I didn't care about. So yeah, for me, it just got to this point where it was like, if I got to get like good at 8 things, I'd rather choose them and, you know, try and work out from there what I wanted to do.
It's funny how that's such a modern sort of privilege. I mean, I imagine that it's not just a Western thing, but the whole being in a situation where you have the luxury of actually pursuing happiness as opposed to just doing what your dad and his dad and his dad and his dad always did. Like I was talking recently, I was interviewing my parents and chatting to them and they do a lot of family history and they're always talking about some of the people they dig up in our family. And they're like, yeah, the dad was a scissor putter together, the mum was a, or that his dad was that. The other one was, you know, a farmer. His son was a farmer. His son's son was a farmer. And it was like, you know, that's the same way for 10 generations. So it's always crazy to me when I think about it now. Even my parents are probably that first sort of generation that got to kind of choose and be able to pursue happiness later on in their lives, I think. Like my grandfather was just an engineer for his entire life and, you know, just had it all kind of set up. But I think he was that generation, my grandparents' generation, born in like the 30s, would be that hardcore, you go to school, finish high school, maybe go to uni if you're a man, get a job, and that's it for the rest of your life. You just keep getting an income, have a family, take care of your family, and then cark it at 60.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, yeah, anyway, it's really interesting that people like you and I'm the same. I went through university. I did 3 degrees all in evolutionary, well, biology, evolutionary biology and evolutionary biology. And then after that was like, oh, fuck this. I'm going to do podcasting. It makes me way happier helping people than just being in a laboratory all day working on stuff alone. Again, with people I don't necessarily like, talking about crap that's not important to me and, you know, whinging about some guy who got a grant that I should have got and, you know, published a paper on something that I thought was cool and was trying to do. And it's just like, oh my God, why are we, you know, this is not my worth my time. I'd rather, you know, learn guitar or do jujitsu or learn languages or, you know, help people.
Do you think
you went through the same thing.
Yeah. Do you think it's due to, so like you hear this phenomenon nowadays of you're going to work an average of like 7 jobs over your lifetime, probably even more for millennials coming through. And I've always just wondered, you know, is that due to technology changes, as in your job gets made redundant so fast that you just need to be into the next one? Or is it having that luxury of searching for your jobs, or like a mixture of both? It's fascinating to think of, you know, what drives that change, because there's definitely still dudes out the mind who are lifers, like, I'm going to be with Rio Tinto till I die sort of thing.
I think there's always people like that though. There are still guys working at the pizza shop that I worked at when I was a teenager who were my age, who'd finished high school and got a job there, and they're still there.
Yeah.
And I think it's a personality thing too, where they're just like, I'm just cruising.
Yeah.
I was saying to Kel, we were driving through a few of these suburbs nearby where they're kind of the lower class suburbs. And again, what I'm about to say doesn't reflect all the people that live there, probably not even, you know, a large percentage of them, but there are definitely a lot of people that you see there that are of the age, you know, that they shouldn't be. And they're doing the kinds of things that teenagers are doing, you know, so you'll see some 50-year-old dude in a hoodie doing drugs in the street and just yelling at someone, or, you know, two guys hanging out together, kicking the footy in the middle of the day. And they're like 55 years old drinking beers. And you're just like, it's really interesting that there are obviously certain kinds of people that are just, I just want to have fun for my entire life with my friends. You know, I don't want anything serious. I don't want a lot of responsibility, and I just want to cruise. And so I think that's the kind of person, you know, there's those sorts of people who are just, get me to my base level of comfort and then I'm set. And I'm just like, everyone else can go fuck themselves. Yeah. I'm just going to do what I want to do. Whereas I think for me and a lot of the people I know, it's like you get this ambition kind of smashed into you as well. And I think you're also, we're sort of taught by society to look at how everyone else is doing around us and try and beat them. And then on top of that, we have the whole life's changing so fast with technology that's changing that, yeah, you know, even my parents had probably 5 jobs each. You know, they've changed. They've worked at universities. They were high school teachers, got bored with that. And then when they were at universities, got made redundant, switched into another parallel position at the same university, and then got made redundant. And then, you know, some department closed and then they had to move into another position. And so constantly upskilling and everything. So it is interesting. But then, as you say, I think we also do have so much crap that we can buy these days, and that we have so much excessive wealth. Right. That I was saying to my folks, you know, did you guys buy us blueberries and strawberries when we were kids? And they were like, we didn't have the money for that in the season. They were out of season. The closest we got was the blackberry bush that we had in the backyard that had fruit on it for 2 weeks a year.
Yeah.
But for my son and my daughter, we go to Woolworths and there's just always blueberries and strawberries and, you know, all these sort of little things that I hadn't thought about, but my wife points out, she's like, that's fucked. No, like, no one in Brazil gets to just spend $7 on a punnet of blueberries and give it to their kid, and that's just their breakfast or something, or, you know, give it to them over a few days. And I'm like, it is so crazy that we've just gotten used to this you know, the way that capitalism works, where we have access to so much stuff. And even with the toys, right? We buy them toys, they break. And I'm like, we're not going to repair this. How much is that going to cost? Who's trained to repair a toy plastic car? We just buy another one, throw this one in the rubbish. And again, my parents would be like, Jesus, we never did that. Our stuff was made of wood and metal. You fix it or you just deal with it. You know, so
you grind it until it's, you know, nothing's left on it. The wheels are square now.
Yeah. But I think it's a gift and a curse. What do you think in terms of the not just being, I wish at times that I could be like that guy who just drank beers and had fun hanging out with his mates until he was 60 years old, you know, during the day on the dole or whatever is that stereotype Aussie bogan kind of trope is. But I just don't think I could ever handle that. I'd be constantly there, like, I've got to do more. I've got to help people. I've got to find meaning. I've got to actually contribute. I've got to make more money. I've got to get a bigger car than the guy next door.
Yeah. There's a lot of things in that. I would say definitely for me, I'm kind of minimalist in a lot of senses. I really hate seeing waste just in general. I don't know if that was something, you know, implanted into me as a kid. I definitely remember my parents being like, you know, you're finishing everything on your plate sort of thing. So
I had that too. You can leave the table when it's an empty plate.
Yeah. Or if it's, you know, if there's literally too much, then it goes in the fridge and you're eating it the next day. So it's not like, you know, avoiding it now is going to make it any better because it's just waiting for you tomorrow, a day older. So
and then your family gets a dog and you're like, oh, thank God. You just sneak it off the plate onto the floor.
I thankfully had a younger brother who was willing to please. So my peas and corn, like the vegetables I didn't like would definitely go his way. And I'm not sure if he liked them, but like he liked me liking him. So
never went to waste.
Yeah. So definitely. There's definitely some things to think about in terms of, you know, is it good to be able to get an apple, you know, a perfect apple all year round? Because, you know, obviously in some months of the year, that apple would be way more harder to, you know, produce versus, you know, the times of the year when it's easy to make apples. So,
well, the thing with apples, though, I think would be that in Australia, at least, I think we follow the seasons as we go up the coast. So I think they kind of ripen sequentially. The thing that's probably really fucked up is that we have avocados year round and we get those locally for summer, and then we get all of the ones from places like Chile and Argentina, right, where they're going through a water crisis because all these farmers are trying to produce avocado. I think Mexico as well is going through that too, where it requires a ridiculous amount of water, right?
Yeah. And I've only heard about like fast fashion recently. I'm just not into buying clothes that much or anything. Like I wear stuff out until it's, you know, too ratty or too holy. And
I feel
like
you. That.
So, like hearing about fast fashion, I was listening to a podcast the other day and I think it was 6,000 tons of fast fashion gets thrown out every 10 minutes just in Australia.
Whoa. So when you say fast fashion, do you want to just sort of describe that for the listeners?
Yeah. So I mean, like, this is going to be real basic in my attempt at it because I only heard about it recently, but essentially just following the fashion trends. And I think this is, I think, more of a woman problem in the sense like that they're just more on top of needing to have the newest gear. And then so if you, you know, have something that comes out in the stores 2 weeks later, it's almost redundant again. And so they've just got all this stock that either needs to go out, and then there's the personal, and, you know, you've bought a wardrobe full of stuff. It's no longer cool anymore. What do you do with it? Do you throw it out? Do you, you know, just leave it sitting in there? What happens with that?
Well, that's so much too to do with the marketing, right? And I would say women are kind of a victim, I would imagine, of the marketing when it comes to fashion, because they'd be the biggest target.
Yeah.
And so it's always like, if you want to be, you know, an attractive woman, make sure that you have this new form of makeup, or make sure that you're wearing this month's certain type of dress, and then, oh no, there's a new one next month, so make sure that you go out there and get this dress if you want to keep up. And that, I can't imagine being on that sort of rat wheel of just constantly having to chase these things in order to keep up. But it feels the same. Yeah, a lot of this is why I imagine you've become a minimalist too, because as soon as I started getting into minimalism, I was like, oh my God, I feel so much more relieved, because now I just don't give a shit about things anymore. I don't care anymore about the big house or owning the Ferrari, or like, oh, okay, those handcuffs are off. I've kind of have that burden off my shoulders. Where, yeah, my dad always has this story about one of his friends who wears high heels and gets really, you know, lots of makeup on, looks stunning every time they go out, but it takes so much effort for her to do it. And he's always like, why are you married? Why do you care what other, you know, guys think? And she's like, I'm not doing this for the guys. I'm doing this so all the other women see me and they're like, damn, that chick's hot. And I was like, oh my God, it's so funny that it becomes this sort of, it's like the guys going to the gym wearing, you know, really tiny singlets. My wife saw one of those guys recently. He was like a bodybuilder and he has like the, what would you call it? Like the tooth floss singlet.
Yeah.
It has like barely like a string over each shoulder. And she's like, why the hell do they wear them? And I'm like, because they want everyone to see the muscles.
Yeah.
And she's like, girls don't like it. It's not for the girls. He's advertising to other guys. He's showing other guys how big he is. Right.
Yeah, like,
so it's a funny thing with that sort of competition between and within sexes.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So how did you get onto minimalism? Was that just something that you were like looking into the whole self-improvement thing?
Yeah, I probably would have been the path. I mean, I've now that I'm getting older, I'm starting to notice like people who are, you know, 10 years younger than me sort of starting on the path that I went down. And I'm just starting to see like, oh, that connects to that, that connects to that. And that's sort of made me who I am. So just on that. So I definitely was very anxious, very shy as a kid. Up until even 20, I would be, you know, crippled with fear getting on the bus. And then like, you know, any girl, it doesn't matter if she was really good looking or not good looking, would sit next to me. And I'd just be, you know, silently freaking out in my corner going like, oh, you know, people are thinking, looking at me, like, what if she says something to me, things like that. So I definitely got on the self-improvement, you know, route journey. And then I think that's when it starts to lead into minimalism. I think there's definitely some connection there with, you know, you'll sort of like start to earn money, for example, or, you know, start to gain status. And then you realize like, oh, you know, what's the point of doing this? If you then get the girl, it's like, oh, what do you need all this stuff for? And things like that. So,
well, that's something that's really interesting that we never seem to ask ourselves. I think we'll never get asked by other people, why are you doing X? You know, what are you trying to achieve by doing X? And I think it's interesting how we kind of just fall on these certain things. Like we find a certain job. Why are you doing the job? Oh, because my parent, you know, if you actually dig in, my parents always wanted me to do it, or it makes a lot of money. It's like, it's funny that when you ask people those sorts of questions, it's very rare that you'll get to the bottom and it's like, oh, because it makes me happy. Because I've always wanted to do this just because I really enjoy X, Y, Z, and it gives me a great feeling of satisfaction. It seems that it's always, well, we're doing it because we want to advertise to other people and society that we're successful. But ironically, that's not success if you measure it in if you're measuring success via happiness, right? It's actually that you're getting further away from that goal quite often, and it's kind of counterproductive.
Yeah. And it's unfortunately one of the things is if you start to ask that question enough, people will start to dislike you
because
you don't like getting brought out of your own routine. So it's one of those traps where, you know, people don't say it because, you know, people won't like you
You're holding a mirror up, right? And being like, have you seen this? Have you seen this?
Yeah. Yeah. So and it's like, you know, equating success with happiness is a bit of a tricky one as well. I really don't like to think of it that way. I usually think more meaning is a better one. Like if I'm finding like the real meaning out of life, getting a, you know, whether it be doing a book review or, you know, trying to learn a one-arm handstand or whatever it is, like that seems to be more, less fickle for me. Happiness for me is a very fickle thing. Like it comes and goes in waves. So I'd try not to focus on that too much. And it's more of like a byproduct of doing all the other things well in my life.
I think that's a fair point because I've been going down this road recently too. And it seems like a lot of the people who talk about this online are like, you're not meant to be pursuing happiness. So, you know, that was sort of shame on me saying that, but meaning, because it's like happiness, like sadness is something that you can't really avoid, but it's also not something that's permanent, it's temporary. And it allows you to you know, find your sort of medium. You get to go through these waves, feel crap, but then as a result, you can feel happier later. If you felt happy all the time, it wouldn't be happiness. It would just be the norm.
Yeah. And then there's all sorts of things such as, you know, if I asked you, would you rather have, you know, imagine all the best things in your life crammed into one day, and then would you take that day if then the subsequent day or, you know, vice versa, was like all the worst day? Like, is your happiness level on the happiest day more than your sadness level on the saddest day. For most people, I imagine they're like me and that they'd say like, no, I wouldn't want to take that hard day just to have that happy day as well.
Yeah, I think my life could be made very, very, very more times sadder and worse than it could be made very, very, very many times happier.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? There is a lot that could be taken away from you that wouldn't be able to be paralleled in terms of people giving me something, right?
Yeah. And that's why happiness is, you know, might not be the right thing to aim for. Maybe it's you should be aiming for like not sadness, you know, trying to just eliminate sadness or eliminate bad things from your life. That's why I liked Stoicism, actually.
Yeah.
I got into that for a while and it was, I found that would be better at like, you know, if like a normal day or a normal year, I experienced these highs and these lows, I'd find that if I had a more stoic mindset, I'd sort of cap them a little bit. Like they'd both come closer to the center, but that would be good because I'd feel the lower ones much more. So, you know, even though I might be taking away a bit of my happiness at the top, like getting rid of that worse sadness or worse hate or anger or whatever it is at the bottom is much, much more better for me.
It's interesting how much just being mindful of these things is helpful too. I mean, I know that you're into meditation. I went down that road for quite a while and then had children. So it's hard to kind of find a quiet moment. But it was interesting when I went down the road of mindfulness and paying attention to what I was feeling as opposed to just kind of living the experience, you know. So if you get angry, as opposed to just riding that wave of being angry and just acting out how you feel, you think, well, why am I angry? What's the real reason for it? Should I be angry? Is this feeling justified? You know, oh, it's because he did this. Did he mean to do this? Oh, okay. So it's not a big deal. And then you're not angry anymore. So it was interesting going down that road and kind of, it feels like it's a way of capping those things, as you say, like the sad parts of your life or the stressful parts of your life, when you're suddenly able to kind of be mindful of these events and kind of step outside of just feeling it, notice it, and then let it pass by, you actually end up being able to deal with a great deal more suffering, or at least the suffering you're dealing with, you can do so much more easily than you could previously. So it's so interesting that this sort of ties in with the amounts of depression that we have today and social media and everything. It seems like everyone's medicated. It's interesting. You wonder if people in the past had these kinds of issues where, you know, the guy in the 1700s working as a factory worker or a farmer was freaking out about being able to buy a Ferrari to impress his neighbor. It's kind of like, I doubt it.
Yeah.
He probably had other problems like the plague or, you know, or the church or whatever, but you wonder if the we have higher peaks and higher valleys now as a result of the way that the modern world is sort of set up.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I read this really good book on depression called The Noonday Demon by Andrew Solomon. One of like just this thick ass book. I think it was like 500, 600 pages. And he just went into everything related to it, you know, his personal experience and then as well as like the science and then personal stories from other people and whatnot. And even just like the history of depression, you know, where did this come from? Like, was this a thing back in the ancient days of Greece and things like that? And yeah, it was still around then. So there's definitely like a chemical or that imbalance in the head, the brain chemistry that's causing it. But yeah, definitely. I mean, like it's, you don't have to go too far in human culture to see some places are better than others and some places are worse than others. And so,
but I wonder if they had that social anxiety, because you would imagine back in the day, even just 100 years ago, you would kind of be born into the life that you were going to have for the rest of your life, right? The position in society that you would always have. You know, if you're born into the upper class, it's pretty difficult for you to end up in the lower class. If you're in the lower class, it's pretty difficult for you to end up in the upper class. Whereas today, I think the message tends to be sent to a lot of people, you can be anything. You can do anything. You can get anything. You can have anything. You can be the most beautiful person in the world if you just, I don't know, work hard enough. You know, it's something that I wonder if that's almost more of a curse than it is a gift, because you end up with that, as we were talking about at the start, kind of like too many choices. And then the kind of, well, okay, all right, so I'll do one thing. Oh, but shit, I could have done these other things. So you never get to feel really satisfied with one thing that you're actually trying to pursue because you're kind of looking everywhere else. I wonder how much it's something we always think we live in the best time when we probably do in a lot of standards.
We definitely do.
Like health. Yeah. But I wonder with regards to, say, mental health or just social anxiety, if we're actually much worse off today than people have been in the past, because it would be something you would imagine a lot of people just never had to think about. They were just like, I don't have to worry about, you know, ever getting this amazing job to impress everyone, because it's just not something that's ever going to be possible.
Yeah. I think I always would say, definitely, like, so glad I'm alive, you know, born 100%. Alive in this century. Like, even if I was, you know, in India, being born alive in this century is way, way better than any other place at any other time, essentially. That's a good question. You know, is hope, you know, detrimental in some sort of sense, in that you false hope or hope that's just so unlikely to be realized, is that more detrimental than just not having that option at all? And it's like, I just got to do this.
Well, a good example, I guess, to sort of give you a concrete one, would be the feminist movement, at least in its third or fourth wave, whatever it is currently.
Like, yeah, there's quite a few waves going on.
Exactly. As opposed to sort of the original ones that were just like, we just want to vote, we want sexual liberty. The ones today where it's kind of like, there's almost, at least in the West, this encouragement of women need to be everything that men are and were in the past, but better. And they shouldn't need any men. They should be able to do everything independently. They need to be able to have the full-time career, make the income equivalent to a guy, have all the children, be a full-on amazing mother, also be, you know, drop-dead gorgeous 24 hours a day and take care of their health at the same time. And you kind of like, I remember chatting to my wife about this quite a few times and being like, there's just the message here. It's not that any of these individual facets has a problem. You know, women who want to follow their career should 100% be able to do that and do as well, if not better than any other man. The same with fitness, the same with family. But it seems like the expectation now is that women need to do it all, you know? And I mean, I'm sure it's the same, but different for a lot of other groups in society where there's a lot of expectations put on you. But that was something I definitely noticed with the more recent feminist manifestation of the movement that has become so much more about women being independent of men and better than, and also the message of just like, you should be able to be a single mother, full-time career lawyer that's rich as fuck and drop dead gorgeous. You don't need no man. And you're kind of like, no one can do that. Like the amount of the, no, there's only 24 hours in a day. There's just no way that you can have a successful family, a successful relationship with your partner, a full-time career, also be hyper fit from going to the gym, also worry about your appearance at all times. Like, there's just no way that all of that can be done. And I wonder how much that pressure, that messaging that's kind of been sent to people, is part of the reason that, you know, there are such high rates of depression amongst women today, especially in conjunction with like social media, right? Where you're always seeing all these people putting up their best images constantly of living their best lives and never get to see behind the scenes. And so you're constantly comparing yourself to all these success stories like Kim Kardashian, not realizing that she's probably fucking miserable, you know, a lot of the time. You just never get to see that, right?
Yeah. I think that's the killer one, the social media. I mean, I don't know if you're the same, but I was able to go from 2012, I'd graduated uni 2013 and I had Facebook then because it helped me with uni. And then I went 2013 through to mid 2019 without having, you know, any of them. And
that's impressive.
That was a blissful life at that point.
You definitely did better than me. with I mean, my whole business is online, and that's the gift and the curse thing of like, I have this amazing business that I absolutely adore. You know, creating content for and working for, but at the same time, it's sort of like I'm handcuffed to social media. There's no real way around doing that because that's how I obviously connect with everyone. So it's such a balance, right? It's like I have to make sure when I'm on social media, and I've been way more focused on it ever since watching that doco, The Social Dilemma, right? Where they really sort of pulled the lid off the whole mechanism inside of social media that's focusing on getting your attention. Excuse me, at all times, and just making you effectively spend more time on the platform so they can show you more ads, and that they've used machine learning and billions of people effectively for the last decade and a half in order to refine this to a perfect skill. And it's so crazy. I open up Facebook, and before I even do what I was trying to do, I've forgotten why I opened it, and I'm just scrolling through you know, at times, and you're just thinking, Jesus Christ, this is, I feel like I just turned into a zombie. So it is interesting, yeah. But I've had to try and avoid using it and being like, I'm going to get in there and post my thing. And then it's kind of like going into the store and being like, don't look at any of the stuff that you want to buy. Just where's the exit? Where's the exit?
Yeah. The infinite feeds are a hell of a thing. I really, I start to see this all the time now where it's, you were talking before about, you know, women who are having to try and do everything. And I always have a chuckle when it's like, you know, you find a person who's, you know, super engaged and then they're like, oh, okay, I'm missing out on my health. So I got to add this into the routine as well. And then it's like, oh, I'm starting to feel burnout. So I'm going to, you know, be productive in my meditation as well. You know, you get to the meditation bit and it's like, oh, okay, I've got to be really productive in meditating. And it's like, when you're trying to get productive in meditating, that's when you've gone too far. That's when it's like, no, now you need to like just chill out. Like you're overthinking things to the point of overthinking. And it, you know, it can be the same things with like the social medias as well. You know, what's their point of getting you on there? Well, to get you on there, to stay longer on there. And you know, obviously for them, there's money involved at some point with the ads and metrics and whatnot. But
when you know, the irony would be that if they charged you, a lot of people would say, I'd be happy to pay to not see ads on Facebook. And it's like 100% they would have had that monetary model originally. And they saw that no one signed up for it, you know, that no one was interested in doing it. And so this is why we end up in this situation where it's a double-edged sword. You know, it's free, but you have to see all these ads and we're going to manipulate the crap out of this system to make sure you watch as many ads as possible. Everyone says, oh, I'd pay money for it. But then that product never gets made, right?